It's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning. You're very welcome along to the 9 to noon show. Last one of the week. It's Friday the 10th of October and it's 5 minutes past nine. I hope you're very well indeed. And we've got a busy 3 hours for you, as we always do, with lots of different stuff on the programme. Our first hour, as it is a Friday, dedicated to the views of three guests discussing and debating some of the big stories of the day and indeed the week. I'll introduce them to you shortly. Just want to invite you to get involved in the conversation, and WhatsApps and texts come into us on 086 60 25000. If you want to give us a call, of course, 074 91 25000 or email, if that's your thing, comments at highlandradio.com. Of course, you can always watch the show if you're at home on your smart TV or your Fire Stick, on the YouTube app and across our Facebook pages and on the X platform. Let's say good morning to Paddy Rooney, Chair of Friends of Letterkenny University Hospital. Good morning, Paddy.
Good morning, Greg.
Thank you so much for joining us as always. Thomas Pringle, former independent deputy, and pretty busy since, it has to be said. Good morning, Thomas.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for joining us. Ben Harkin is Chair of O'Grafina Fall in Donegal and an author as well. Well done, Ben. Good morning to you.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks very much for having me.
Lots to get through. I suppose we should start with the big news breaking overnight. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office has confirmed that the government had approved the framework of a hostage release deal with Hamas as both sides edged closer to ending more than 2 years of hostilities in Gaza. Considering the unresolved phase two issues like Hamas's disarmament, the timeline for a full Israeli troop withdrawal, the future governance and reconstruction of Gaza, and the need for mutual trust, what are the primary challenges, do you think, to the Trump-brokered Israel-Hamas ceasefire deal leading to a durable and lasting peace in the Middle East, Ben?
Yeah, so firstly, the main problem is that the bombing was supposed to stop as soon as the Israeli government agreed to ceasefire. That hasn't happened. The reporting at the minute from the BBC is that there's still bombing going on. Some of the Israeli army has withdrawn and started to withdraw. In other areas, it hasn't. There's still armoured vehicles and that left. So that's the main issue. When the bombing stops, there's then 3 days for Hamas to release the hostages. So I think that that's going to be a very tense 3 days. And then as well, you know, the Israeli army are withdrawing to agreed lines. They're going to withdraw then to, I think, 40% of control and then back to 15%, you know, of control. So a very, very long way to go before there's any sign of an enduring peace, especially when we see the Israeli national security minister is very much against this, has said that the government could collapse over this deal if it doesn't work out. So we're a very long way, I think, from seeing an enduring peace. Hopefully we'll get it. We need to get it, but we're a long way from it yet.
Thomas, once the hostages who should never have been held are returned back to the Israelis, what is to stop Israel, you know, either false flags or genuine encroachments or whatever it might be, and saying, right, now we go in and we finish the job? There's a lot of trust has to be put in the Israeli government and indeed Donald Trump, and I wonder how trusting the people of Gaza might actually be in that regard. Not that we've heard anything from them, really. They've been the quiet voice in all of these negotiations.
Well, you can't hear from the people of Gaza anyway, because it's very difficult to actually try and get any comments from them. I mean, I think that's, you hit the nail on the head there, Greg. You know, once the hostages are released and the hostages are handed over, what's to stop the Israelis then just doing what they want to do? And unfortunately, we've been here before, where there was a previous peace agreement last year, which was breached within a matter of weeks, and the war continued on. So I would like to think that it would be peace, but I don't think I would be very wary of saying it is going to be at this stage. I think it's very one-sided, and I think that, you know, the Americans have shown that they are party to the conflict, and they're not actually peace brokers. You know, so we'll just have to wait and see what happens. Hopefully the killing will stop and the Israelis will stop slaughtering people in Gaza, but I just wouldn't be that well confident at the moment.
Yeah, but and that's based on looking backwards. But I suppose to look forward, you know, maybe the pressure was on in Israel. Enough is enough. You know, maybe there's a broader Middle Eastern plan that can, you know, suit everybody. Maybe there's more to play for in terms of a broader peace, especially if, you know, there's business opportunities in the redevelopment of Gaza. I'm trying to put a positive swing on it, but I mean that
business opportunities are Trump Towers on the beaches of Gaza. I mean, is that what the people of Palestine can look forward to, and the people of Gaza can look forward to? That to me isn't a peaceful resolution. And you know, it wouldn't inspire confidence when you see that Trump is recommending Tony Blair to be the head of this body that's going to look after the peace. Who's Tony Blair, who was actually putting forward the Gaza plan and the plan for Trump Towers originally, you know. So I mean, and you know, we talk about peace and stuff like that there, but yet all European governments, including our own, are facilitating Israelis in carrying out the slaughter and allowing the transport of war materials to Israel. You know, so there's not much sign of peace, unfortunately. And we need to, I think, governments need to listen to their own people and actually have a just and fair peace, and hopefully that'll come, but I just wouldn't be that confident at the moment.
Paddy Rooney, what's your views?
Well, it took 4 years after the IRA ceasefire in August 1994 before the Good Friday Agreement was signed, and there was a lot of blips and slips along the way. So it would be an extraordinary thing if an intractable problem like this, with so much bitterness in it, that, you know, things can be resolved very, very quickly. I mean, Thomas is right anyway, that the whole peace deal, it's very one-sided and it's very unfair, because Hamas are, either they've been given an ultimatum or they have agreed to A, disarm, B, leave, and C, not be part of any future administration, which here we are now, you know, outside countries are telling the Palestinians about who they are, who should govern them, that they can't decide that themselves. Israel, I can't ever imagine a situation where Israel are actually going to pull their army out. I know Ben gave percentages there about the Israeli army, about what they're, where they should be pulling back to. I think I read somewhere last night about 53% of the land space of Gaza, that Israel will have a military presence in there for some time until there is some kind of a peace deal. It would be an extraordinary thing if it would hold, because Ben did make the point about the Israeli government here. There is a sizable chunk of that government who don't actually want this peace deal.
Well, they're on the brink. The further on the right, they're on the brink. So if there's any indication that Hamas is on the rise or active or has any influence, there are those within the government that have threatened that that's the red line. They will take the government down. So it's a very fragile piece for the Israeli government as well.
Absolutely. And remember, you don't need an army of 5,000 people or soldiers within Hamas to create some kind of an incident. It's as little as about 4 or 5 people can do that. And I have a suspicion as well that the Israel will only be looking for an excuse to resurrect this again, because they know well that they've got the support of the Americans to do this. And the Arab world seems completely neutered on this, and they're very, very silent on this. I mean, they haven't played a very high profile in this over the last 2 years. And, you know, that you would expect that there would be sort of advocates or mentors for the people of Palestine, but they don't appear to be doing that. So it's very much one-sided, and I think there's a long way to go in this yet.
Yeah, but Ben, there'll be a lot of people who may necessarily not involve themselves in the history of this that will wake up this morning saying, do you know what? Hopefully now that's the end of the bloodshed. It's ironic that Israel would deny a genocide, yet part of the deal is actually food getting into starving people, which I think is an admittance of what they were doing in and of itself, Ben. But I think there's a lot of people who are, you know, not necessarily into the left and right politics, the Trump, the Benjamin Netanyahu's, the Iran's, the this, that and thon, that will just wake up this morning and say, hopefully now this is, you know, Trump's done something here, whether you like him or not. You know, hopefully now these kids have a future.
Absolutely. Listen, I think we're all hoping that this is going to lead to an enduring peace. I think on Trump, you know, Trump is going to take a massive amount of credit for this. If it does lead to lasting peace, that's fantastic. It has to be acknowledged his role in sort of, you know, standing with the Israeli army the whole time. He moved the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. He stood with Israel when they
took
over the Golan
Heights.
But
he did inherit this mess to some extent, though, didn't he? And he has brought it to a hopefully, seemingly, a resolution.
Hopefully he has, but I just think that when we look back in the context of this entire conflict as well, that, you know, Trump does have his role in how far that he's stood with Israel. Like I say, hopefully this is going to lead to a peace. Benjamin Netanyahu, I suppose, because of his own political issues in Israel, needs this government to last, needs this government to last as long as possible. So it's whether or not this government is willing to stand behind it, the Israeli government is willing to stand behind this peace deal, is going to be the problem.
You would have no praise for Trump in this process, Thomas?
No. I don't think that Trump is an honest broker in relation to the peace deal. And, while he talks about peace, the Americans are continuing to arm the Israelis to the teeth. And, peace could have been delivered to the Middle East at any stage over the last number of years by simply turning off the flow of weapons to the Israelis. And, if you were concerned about the slaughter of Palestinians, that's what would be done. Indeed, could be done by many European governments as well, to ensure that peace would be delivered.
Well, that's if we choose a side. We could turn off the flow of weapons into Ukraine, and whether we like how that might conclude, it would conclude one way or other.
But the reality is that we have chosen a side by the fact that we continue to arm Israel and to allow them to continue a genocide in Gaza. And that's the reality of the situation. So the European Union, European governments, indeed our own government, the Americans are all complicit in this. And we have chosen that, whereas the people have chosen a different option and have pushed the governments to ensure that there would be a difference carried out there. And that's the reality of the situation. This could have been stopped at any time over the last couple of years. And unfortunately, I hope that it's the end of it.
And I know we can go into the history of it and all, but you saying this could have been stopped in a moment, Thomas, but that doesn't factor into the fact that there are others around Israel that would also like to see it eliminated, and that Hamas would probably have felt empowered to rearm and continue their attacks as well. Like, I'm not trying to play this down the middle just for the sake of playing it down the middle, but that is the truth. You know, if Israel had not done what they'd done, you know, what was to come in terms of further attacks on their country? There's no justification for what they did do, but we can't sort of completely eliminate that from the conversation either.
But you have justified it to Greg just by what you're saying there, that, you know, if Israel didn't do what they did, what else would have happened?
No, because obviously the response was completely disproportionate. You know, I'm not in any way justifying what went on thereafter, but my point is it's not like Israel stopped what they're doing and then just everyone got on with their life, because there still, you know, would be an active conflict there.
Yeah, an active conflict has been fostered by Israel for the last 40, 50 years. This wasn't the first attack by Israel on Gaza. This is actually, I think, the fourth intifada that has taken place since 2000. You know, so this has been ongoing for a very long time. And the reality is that Israel could have had a peaceful resolution at any point during this. I don't think any of the Israel's neighbours have been attacking Israel for many, many, many years. At this stage, Israel has been operating the Gaza Strip basically as a concentration camp for the last 20 years since the turn of the century, and Israel has been continuing on this situation. So, in reality, if they wanted peace, there could have been peace a long time ago. But we are where we are now, and whether there'll be peace in the future. And under this deal, I hope there will be, but I just wouldn't have wide confidence yet, because I do, as you said yourself earlier on, as soon as Hamas release the hostages, what's to stop the Israelis from going back in there again? And that's the reality, I think, of the situation.
Finally, before we move on, Patrick, it's very early in this process, but say there is a lasting peace here. How do you think our, you know, grandchildren will learn about this, will be taught about this? I mean, it's been accepted generally that there was a genocide. It's been accepted generally there was a man-made famine. And also, you know, 60, 70, 80,000 people murdered. How do you think history will reflect on it, you know, when this is in the copy books? We're living in this now, right? And we sort of look back at what happened in Nazi Germany, for an example, and we frame it in a certain way. But we've kind of been sitting on watching something not dissimilar, but not at the same scale, happening right now. How do you think it will be reflected on in history books?
Well, as a general rule, Greg, the winners of a war always write the history. So there will be a certain flavour, I suppose. There is an ad doing the rounds at the moment for Volkswagen cars, and Volkswagen are celebrating their 75th anniversary of selling cars in this country. So by my reckoning, that means that they were exporting Volkswagen cars into Ireland in 1950. That's only 5 years after the end of the Second World War, when Nazi Germany did what they did, the Holocaust and a whole range of other barbarities that they enacted. But it just goes to show you, in such a very small period of time, normalization, the page has been turned, and normalization has resumed. And I suspect that the very same thing is going to happen here. You know, we had it in Yugoslavia with the Serbs and the Croats when, you know, the Serbian army, I know this mightn't qualify as a genocide in the same realms of what happened in Gaza, but very, very quickly the page get turned. We want to forget these things too, of course, Greg, because they're very unpleasant to think about. And the next thing is then when you turn the page, there's a new conflict.
I still think there's still a general hangover for Germany, if we could put it like that. You would have much of their culture, much of their architecture was wiped from the face of the earth. You know, a lot of music that you go and try and find German traditional music from a certain time over in Germany, they're still too embarrassed to sort of back it and play it because of its association. I do take your point, but I do think the impacts of what they did still do to. And do you know what? There's much of East Germany aren't really that don't regret the past too much either. Now, the government has delivered its Budget 26, labelling it as a sensible and prudent package designed for stability. But outside the door, the reaction is less measured. Opposition have launched a scathing attack, with some calling it a Big Mac budget for rewarding multinationals and a budget of broken promises. Crucially, though, with no general income tax cuts and the popular one-off cost of living payments now withdrawn, independent analysis suggests that many working people will see their real disposable income shrink next year. Was this budget fundamentally a failure for the ordinary worker and the struggling family? And did the government prioritise long-term savings and developer tax breaks over the immediate needs of the people? Or were those measures a positive means to an end? Thomas, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think you summed it all up there, Greg. I mean, basically, this is a budget that has ignored working people, and actually people are worse off after this budget. As you said, it's been reported in the media today, I think something like about 5 or 6% worse off individuals are. And that's shocking when you look at then that the tax breaks that have been given to developers for the development of housing in Dublin, and actually tax breaks then that have been given to, while it has will benefit some of the smaller businesses across the country, it is the likes of McDonald's and Supermax that are going to benefit from those breaks.
But just in relation to the tax break for developers or builders or whatever the phraseology is there's something like 40 or 50,000 planning permissions granted. The government believes this will kickstart the development of those properties now and deliver the much needed housing. I mean, I know it's in Dublin and we'd love it up here, but you know, we can't be too parochial all of the time.
Well, you look at all the tax breaks that are given to developers at every turnaround, and that hasn't kickstarted the development of houses at any stage. You know, there's a huge amount of speculation taking place in relation to planning permissions. Developers get land rezoned, they get a plan permission, they use that then to increase the value of it and sell it on, and then the purchaser of that land then uses more tax breaks to sell that on. And so what you're getting is a massive trading in developable land, but no actual development taking place. And you know, that's clear that the government's policy in relation to housing has failed, and failed utterly, when you see that the homelessness figures across the country and the amount of people that are in need of housing. And what we need to do is a complete rethink and a re focusing of policy to actually the delivery of houses rather than the delivery of profit to developers.
And yeah, but you always will need a bit of public-private partnership in these developments of this scale.
Yeah, the public-private partnership that you have is that the local authorities actually develop, advertise the land and get contractors to build the houses, not developers to profiteer on the
Well,
value.
We've tried that, and we've got...
No, we haven't. We actually haven't tried it, Greg.
The couple of times I know we didn't acquire the land, but the couple of times that we've had deals with contractors to deliver properties, we end up quibbling about pricing and those houses get lost.
I don't really think that's
right. Happened in Milford and stuff. Okay, I know the exact, but I don't want to get bogged down.
If you look at how housing has been developed over the last since the foundation of the state, right up until probably the last 15 or 20 years, local authorities advertised the land that they had. They employed a developer, a builder, to build the houses on those lands, and the houses were developed and given out, and it wasn't based on price and based on profit for developers. And when you have a system that's geared totally to profit and to developers making profit, this is what you get. You get speculation, and you get no developer is going to want to see house prices going down, because then they're not going to be profitable. So that's when you have profit is what is dividing your policy and driving your policy. This is what happens.
Yeah. Okay, Ben, what's your view? Ben Harkin now, obviously, as a chair of Old Gryffindor Fall in Donegal, I presume you see this budget, do you, as generally positive?
I think we've seen, Greg, what's happened in this country when we've continued to sort of increase spending and reduce our tax base while we have a really concentrated tax base. So, at one point that was on property and property tax. Now it's corporation tax. So I think we have to be careful with how we manage that there.
Yeah, but they've spent the majority of that corporation tax. That's the problem, you see. That corporation tax is actually in general everyday spending.
It is an everyday general spending, but we're also putting a lot of away. The opposition have spent twice as much in their budgets as we have. I think that fundamentally this here is about making sure that there's, 19 billion allocated for capital investment. So things like housing, electricity, transport, making sure that we're reducing the underlying costs that's watering down people's paycheck. The Irish Fiscal Advisory Council said that 1.9% of inflation is due to high spending. So I think we've seen that the temporary payments the government putting out, that while they've been helping people, they've also been putting up inflation, and they've been watering down people's paychecks, essentially. So I think it's important that, we get a handle on that there. These supports were always going to be temporary, and they had to come to an end at some point. Yeah. We've seen permanent reductions in things like college fees, which I think is good. But again, for people sending someone to college, that cost is housing. I think that we have two bottlenecks when it comes to housing, planning for houses. When it comes to apartments, one of the problems is that it's very hard to make apartments break even. I think this here, tax break for that there, given that it's out to 2030, is going to give people confidence. I know that some people don't like people making profit. That is an incentive. And I think that we need to see dense housing built for students, dense housing built in our cities. And I think that that there is going to help us.
You think this will... You talk about... So do you believe it's intentional to have working people having less money to cool the economy down? Is that what you're saying? Sorry, I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. I think that fundamentally, I know as a young professional, I would like, if the tax brackets would have been changed, that would have been good. But, you can't do everything. You have to make choices. This was a choice that the government made.
Well, that's exactly what we're debating, the choices, Ben.
The idea is that this here is making sure that the economy is stable, that the tax base isn't
been watered down. Is it a clever use of money? Say, for instance, I think McDonald's made close on 50 million euro profits last year in Ireland alone, a very small market, that they are now going to get this massive tax break. Could we not have... I know people are going to say, well, VAT and EU and rules and all that kind of stuff, but there surely could have been a more nuanced approach to help the small and medium business without literally shoveling cash into the pockets of KFC, Burger King, McDonald's and all the other multinational food outlets.
Yeah, I think it would have been good if it could have been targeted. I think that once you start to target things, it becomes harder and harder to implement them. You do have EU rules to try and deal with.
The entire VAT reduction is targeting business. It's targeting food and it's targeting hairdressing. So that is a targeted measure. It's just not
Oh, it is tagging, and listen, it's ensuring that that's, you know, that's what them businesses were calling for, that's what them sectors were calling for in the lead up to the budget last year, and now that's what they've got this year. I think that you want to make sure that you're keeping jobs, that you're keeping people in jobs, and I think that that there is what this is going to do.
Do you think it will deliver housing, student accommodation, roads, and investment into Donegal this budget?
I think it's delivering a commitment to that there. Delivery is the hard part. And like I said before, and we've discussed this when I've been on the show before, that the bottleneck for it is that we've seen before money been committed. And the problem is then is getting it through the planning, getting it then actually built. You need a pipeline. It's very difficult to just start building an awful lot of houses. But I think we're seeing an increase. And I think that now we're starting to get there.
Mm.
And this is a commitment.
Mm-hmm. Paddy Rooney?
I think the reason why so many people, Greg, feel worse off now as a result of the budget is down to inflation. So the fact that their wages aren't going to go or their income isn't going to go as far as it had done previously. I mean, if you look at the, I'm right in saying that the increase in old age pensions in this budget was €10 per head.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and I were out socially on Tuesday evening and Mary bought a bottle of Diet Coke or a glass of Diet Coke, a medium glass of Diet Coke, and it cost €3.75. So the increase, the much lauded increase in the pension wouldn't buy you three glasses of Coke, right? Mm-hmm. And by the time we get to March and April of next year, that income actually will count for a lot less than that. Richard Curran wrote a good article in The Independent a couple of weeks ago before the budget, and he said that the single biggest driver to inflation in this country was government policy. And he listed a whole list of measures and actions by the government. Housing, for instance, that there is a problem with the supply side of housing, right? But all the different schemes that the governments have been putting in place since 2011, all that they have actually done is that drove up the price of housing and put additional money into landlords and developers' pocket, period. He gave an example as well. We'll say, for instance, about insurance. 60% of the population now apparently have health insurance. But government policy now in relation to the new POP contracts for new hospital consultants and trying to get existing consultants to move away from their private-public contract to a public-only contract. It means that there's less and less now private care being delivered in public hospitals, which is a good thing. But the downside of that is because there's so much of the population have health insurance, they're moving to private hospitals. But the provision of private healthcare in private hospitals is more expensive than the provision of private care in a public hospital, if you can understand it. So that's why the health insurance is going through the roof. I mean, I filed my returns for the local property tax yesterday to find out, hey, presto, they're gone up as well. So everything, a lot of government policy in relation to this is driving things up. He had a scary figure as well, I think, before the budget of 2019. That was the one immediate before the COVID economic outbreak in 2020. That the spend by the government that year, 2019, was $44 billion. Pascal Donoghue announced measures on Tuesday for $108 billion. That is a massive increase by any stretch of the imagination. And all that additional money, Greg, is chasing the same number, the same level of goods and services. Now, there's only one way that this is going to go here, but that can't continue. There was $10.6 billion put into the economy additionally last year. This is supposed to be a more measured affair, but we find out that it's about $9.3 billion. And so if you have a situation where you have more and more money chasing the same number of goods, it's inevitable how that's going to go, and it's going to be inflation. And every single cost of living measure that the government do, whether it's public service pay or social welfare increases or whatever it is, the level of inflation just
Yeah, but at least, though, like at least with widening tax bands, you can catch up with it or you can keep pace with it. You might not advance, but certainly you can try and stand still. The way it is now is that what many people working aren't. But there's a lot of stuff that's not addressed, like, you know, like I still haven't had a legitimate explanation ever to me about why we have the highest electricity rates in Europe, yet we seem to be talking mostly about wind farms and solar and all this type of stuff. So what is that? Is that the levy on that? Food inflation running over at 5%, yet all the companies are making massive, massive profits. The cost of insurance, car insurance, when, you know, car insurance companies are making, you know, record profits again. As we know, ESB and other electricity companies making record profits. You know, the environment seems to be very favourable to people who are rich or are in big business or supplying core services. And yet we're spending more money to make the general population poorer. I can't figure that. I'm not even close to an accountant. And I don't think anything I've said there could actually be contested by Micheál Martin. I've not said anything anti-government or anything shocking there. I've just kind of laid out a few, as I would see them, as obvious facts.
Well, you see, Greg, that governments are supposed to be like our parents. They're supposed to give us what we need rather than what we want, okay? But there was a famous US economist called Thomas Sowell, and he had a saying one time that the first rule of economics is that resources are finite, but the demands on those resources are infinite. Okay, and he went on to say that the first rule of politics is to disregard the first rule of economics. Okay, because one of the things we're becoming very Americanized in this country, because way back Thomas was a public representative himself, so he'll know this. That, you know, things like professional lobbyists, and we didn't have that to a greater or lesser degree in this country, but we do have it now. Because be under no illusion, Greg, that the VAT on food and hospitality, the reduction, that's come about as a direct result of professional lobbying.
Well, can I
on
add to that too? Because I might be overly cynical, but I cannot imagine there wasn't a meeting somewhere where builders or developers or whatever they're called said, see those 40,000 apartments that you've got planning for, we aren't going to touch them. Because even the government can see this is not about affordability, it's about profitability. It's not about affordability for people buying houses, it's profitability for those that might build them. So I can't imagine that there's this vacuum of space whereby these builders and developers didn't say to the government, those 40,000, we'll let them slide, we don't care, unless you put more money in our pockets. So,
Greg, if I could come in there, just
yes,
you made
please.
A point there about energy, you know, and how we have the highest energy costs. And that there affects everybody. That affects, you know, the person with their take-home pay, paying their electricity bill of the house. It affects the business, paying their rate. There's a couple of problems in that there. We're at the end of a pipeline when it comes to natural gas and that there. That's a significant problem. So we're paying the most expensive prices for it. The day-ahead price is often set by the natural gas. We're also letting a lot of energy go to waste. I've discussed this before with you, but energy in Donegal, energy along the west of Ireland is going to waste because we can't transport it. In this budget, there's money being invested in improving this infrastructure and making sure that the energy in Donegal isn't going to waste, and making sure that that cheap energy that's developed right along the west of Ireland can be
what
used
do you mean,
in the
cheap
grid
energy? Well,
down
not,
the cost.
It's not cheap energy. We actually said we'll pay you the exact same as we pay for coal-fired energy for your wind energy, and we're still doing it. It's not cheap energy. It's costing us an absolute fortune.
And the reality is, Greg, that when we had a single energy supplier in the ESB, we had the second cheapest electricity in Europe. But European law and the Irish government decided that we had to have competition in the market. So the view was that electricity was too cheap to have competition. So they set out about increasing the cost of electricity to the end user to make it more attractive to get companies in to actually compete in the marketplace. And that is what has happened. Where we were in a situation where we had cheap electricity, we've now created a system where we have expensive electricity so that the market can compete and make profits.
We had cheap electricity compared to Europe because our economy was one of the worst in Europe. That's why it's similar when you look at other poorer economies in Europe now. They have cheaper electricity prices.
But Ben, go ahead, Thomas, to make your point. Sorry, I shouldn't be.
No, this is the kind of stuff that we hear from Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael all the time. You know that the market has to decide, and we haven't got to act as a market, so therefore we have to put up with it and all this kind of stuff here. The reality is that our government could take a different view and a different choice, and this is about choices, and it is about economic choices that the government has made. And the government has decided that their choice is going to be to support businesses and to give tax breaks to businesses to allow the businesses to make more profit. And that's the choice that the government has made. What I believe, and if you look at it, even the comment was made over the last couple of weeks in relation to the cost of the VAT reduction for businesses could employ, I think it was 30,000 extra nurses across the country. What would the spending power of 30,000 extra nurses employed across the country mean for the small businesses that need it? And that would actually...
With that being said, there has been a retraction. There has been a lot of hospitality businesses closing, and there's been a retraction in the amount of people employed in them. But anyway...
Yeah, because there's also a lot of hospitality businesses opening as well. Like, and actually, yeah. Figures have shown as well that employment in hospitality businesses actually increased over the last number of years.
I thought it would come down 3 or 4%.
So that actually means that unfortunately, you do get a lot of churn in hospitality businesses. I think I read somewhere recently that the average lifetime for a restaurant to be open in Dublin is something like 2 years.
Okay.
So you know, so there is a business and industry that's a lot of churn.
Ben, sorry, I don't want to actually finish your point, but how does investing more in the power infrastructure, like, are you saying that you believe this will reduce our electricity costs? Honestly, because you put that forward as a solutionist. Do you actually think that spending 1.52 billion euro on the electricity infrastructure that we're paying for the most part, we're paying for all of it actually, will reduce prices?
If you have a wind farm, say along the west of Ireland, and it can't generate because there's nowhere to move the electricity, then that cheap electricity, even if you don't want to say it isn't cheap, it's just electricity, isn't being used at all. That generator isn't making any money. So what they're going to do is when they're selling their electricity the next day, when they're selling electricity when they can use it, they're going to put up their price because they're trying to make back their investment. That's what happens. So if you can actually use that electricity all the time,
it's an option to store this power, though. I mean, have we up our entire
use it right
landscape
now.
Have we, we've messed up our entire right landscape for power we can't get at? Is that what you're saying?
You can do two things with energy. You can use it right now, or you can store it. So you can store it in batteries. We're seeing now more and more batteries being built. Or you can use it right now. The only way you can use it right now is if you have either the demand there or you can move it to the demand. A lot of the time right now, we can't move it to the demand.
So why did we allow these wind farms to be built then?
Because land's cheaper along the west, then the electricity is cheaper
if we
because
can't
you're not using
the power,
areas.
If we can't use the power and get it into the infrastructure, which is your fundamental argument for the investment, why did we allow these wind farms to be built in the first place on our peatland?
Because that's where wind farms are built. They're built in rural areas. Okay. And this is all sort of part of a process.
So they're just
we've
nice
seen
big
over the last
then.
Few years
okay.
improvements in our electricity infrastructure. And now this is the next part of
okay,
it as well.
Okay, so we've seen the improvement in our infrastructure. Where has the reduction in electricity costs come from?
There's been a global increase in electricity costs. That's come from a global increase in fossil fuel prices.
We pay the
prices.
Most expensive.
And like
in
I says, the day-ahead price is set by the most expensive generator, which a lot of the time is the fossil fuel generator. So that's a problem that we have. And as we're increasing our renewables, as we're increasing our battery storage, that there's pushing that expensive
but
generator
we've seen,
out.
We're seeing electricity prices go up. We're not seeing them come down.
Well, as in the day-ahead prices, which I look at, you know, as an industry, is coming down. We need to see that there consistently for people to reduce their prices. We need to see more competition in this market as well, which is a problem. It's a problem across the EU if we're going to see it come down for households.
We need to be able to compete.
Fundamental market price come down.
As far as I'm aware, countries that have the same balance of power usage as we have, their electricity prices are significantly smaller than ours. But anyway, listen, that's your view, and I'm not here to say it's right or wrong. Grab a coffee. We'll be back in 4 minutes to wrap up this segment of the programme. This hour, frustratingly short. But we've time for our last item. And following the shock withdrawal of Jim Gavin, the presidential contest is now a binary choice. Fine Gael's former minister, Heather Humphreys, against independent, left-leaning Catherine Connolly. Paddy Rooney, does this simplify the election into a clear political battle between the establishment and the anti-establishment left? And how do you think Jim Gavin's votes, which will still be counted, and he could still blummin' win the thing, ultimately, how do you think his transfers, if they come into play, will determine the winner?
Well, I suppose Micheál Martin has had a lot of Obrim tossed on his shoulders now as a result of Jim Gavin's withdrawal. But this may well not be the end of this, Greg, and that this could descend into complete farce altogether if Jim Gavin actually ends up getting a sizeable vote. It's highly unlikely that he's going to win this, but if he did, we would have something akin to a constitutional crisis here, because I presume he would have to, or he doesn't want the job now, so he would have to resign or withdraw from or whatever. But it's looking like that. The most recent presidential debate on the radio, RT1 radio yesterday, is coming across that way. Heather Humphreys is becoming much more, I think, aggressive in the way she's challenging Catherine Connolly. And she is sort of, not sort of, but standing up for the government. And Catherine Connolly seems to be attacking the government all the time now. So it is, it does have the appearance now of the establishment versus the disestablished candidates, whatever is the right word for it. So we'll see how it plays out. But people will be hoping that Jim Gavin has gone away here and gone away properly.
Who do you think will win?
He hasn't gone away, if you know what I mean.
Who do you think will win?
Push me and I'll say Heather Humphreys.
Okay.
But it wouldn't surprise me if Catherine Connolly would.
I wouldn't have to push Thomas Pringle too hard to get Heather, to get Catherine Donnelly's Catherine Connolly's voice name out of his mouth. How do you see things panning out? And people will know, I presume people will know that you're a fierce supporter of Deputy Connolly. But how do you think things will pan out over the next couple of weeks, Thomas?
Yeah, and I would clarify that I'm supporting Catherine Connolly and working on, as part of her campaign. Yeah. I think it's going to be very interesting. I think that contrary to what Paddy's saying there, that Catherine is going to win, and is going to win well in relation to the campaign. And I think that's vitally important. And it is, I think that's something that scares the life out of the establishment, the fact that a united candidate who all the parties of the left have, and independents together, have united behind her campaign and in support of her campaign. And it will send out a very clear message for the next general election as well afterwards, which I think is very significant and very important.
Does Catherine need statistically, because I know you guys are very good at drilling into the figures, does she need Jim Gavin's voters to stay at home?
It's not for me to say what Fianna Fáil voters are going to do, but I think that possibly Fianna Fáil voters will stay at home. And basically it was looking when Jim Gavin was there that Heather Humphreys would need to get about five or six times the amount of transfers from Jim Gavin than Catherine in order to pass her out and win the election. So that, I would imagine, still in play there. It depends whether Fianna Fáil people will decide to go out and vote for Fine Gael or not, or whether they stay at home. We just have to see how that pans out.
Okay.
But even if they did vote in favour of Catherine or of Heather Humphreys, she still has an uphill task to try and defeat Catherine, and I think that's very important. And I think it gives an opportunity for a very historic result to take place here and leading into the general election then, which could really change how this country works.
Yeah, Ben, what's your view?
Well, Jim Gavin, I suppose, was on 15%, in the last poll. So, like, the undecideds in that poll was on 35%. So there's, I suppose, significantly more room in that than even there was in Jim Gavin. So I'd have to agree. I think probably people will end up staying at home. I do think that this election has sort of failed to inspire people. I think the highlight for a lot of people has been Catherine Connolly doing Kiki ups, so it hasn't really, I think, caught the attention. I think it's going to be a very low turnout, people that are sort of already planning on going out to vote before the election. It's very hard to call. It's going to be that undecided more than it's going to be the Jim Gavin vote that's going to decide it.
Just one question I'll throw out to the three is, see the media coverage of this, is it completely and utterly only focused on trying to get people out of this race, be Catherine Connolly asking her hypothetical questions or Heather Humphreys trying to extrapolate some links to something or other? And, obviously worthwhile exposing some of the problems with Jim Gavin. But I'm looking through the newspapers and it seems every single journalist, all they're interested in doing is not actually relating info, but is to actually getting someone out of this race or getting the next award. Am I being unfair there, or does it seem particularly nasty from a journalistic perspective this year?
I think all presidential elections have been that way over the last number of elections anyway, Greg. And you know, and it could be because of the actual president's role as such doesn't have much in terms of policy making.
So you have to go for the man rather than the ball then?
Yeah, yeah. The focus then is on the individual during the campaign.
Paddy, the last 20 seconds to you, sorry.
One of the things I'll say for sure anyway is when I say about Heather Humphreys that I think she'll win, I don't say that with any great degree.
No, you did delay for quite some time.
But I'll say this, though. I think that Catherine Connolly is much more in control of her own destiny than Heather Humphreys is in control of hers. If Catherine can curb some of the wee bit of slips or uncertainties around employing a rapist or, referring to
that question was strange. That's like asking the boss of a company if he ever assaulted his wife, and the answer is yes, I did, or he denied that he did. It's a loaded question.
It's a completely hypothetical question.
That's the kind of question. It's like saying if someone came into your house and was about to kill your child, would you shoot them? You know what I mean? It's just is that what it's descended to? And there's other silly questions that have been asked of other candidates as well. I don't understand that question.
Neither do I, because it's very unfair. Like.
Right, Paddy, I wish I had another hour. We'll chat to you really soon. Thanks very much indeed. Paddy Rooney, look after yourself. Thomas, always good to have you on the show. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
And Ben, well done. Sterling defence of Fianna Fáil and government policy. Not easy, I suppose, but thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much. You did all right.
Take care of yourself. All right, that was the first hour of the show. Thanks for all your comments. I'll be getting to as many of those as I possibly can over the next couple of hours.